Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. Austin, I thought a great place to start would be to go back to the beginning of your real estate journey and how you got into real estate, why real estate was at all interesting to you.
Yeah. So for me, real estate started when I was a child because my dad was a carpenter, which meant that I was around real estate my whole life. I was swinging a hammer when I was 3 years old. And so by the time I turned 18, I went and got my real estate license and started selling real estate as a way to pay for college and ended up going on to law school after undergrad. And by that moment in time, I had been selling real estate for about 5 years. And I was driving around town, chasing buyers and sellers to get documents signed on the hood of my car. And that led to the first real estate tech idea that I had, which was Dotloop, and created that company in 2008, 2009 period. And have been in the business ever since.
So right when real estate started to implode, you decided to start a real estate tech company.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And really largely out of kind of accident, it was by accident, I guess, if you will, meaning I wasn't really thinking holistically about kind of the macro real estate situation at the time. I was just experiencing this problem that I was facing firsthand as a real estate agent, trying to get documents signed. And I was feeling the pain of my customers, you know, that were also kind of working and had their own lives. And I saw a problem that needed to be solved. And that's really what led to the creation of my first company. And that's one of the most important lessons that I've learned in entrepreneurship, actually, is that solving a problem that you're really passionate about, I find to be a critical ingredient to succeeding as an entrepreneur, because it's so hard to build businesses and lead teams and solve problems. It better be something that you're really passionate about, number one. And if it's not a real problem that you're solving in the first place, good luck, because a lot of the other odds are stacked against you when creating a company. So yeah, it just kind of happened by accident. And after sort of realizing that I had started a company in real estate at one of the toughest times for the real estate market at large, at first it felt like a real disadvantage. And I started asking myself, was this the right idea, you know, to invest my whole life into this business? But in hindsight, it turned out to be a really great time to start a business. And I've had other opportunities during down cycles or challenging markets throughout my entrepreneurial career that were very analogous to that, where what feels like a disadvantage or a weakness in the moment oftentimes breeds opportunity and becomes a really transformative moment for the company when you reflect back.
Why do you think those downtimes are so ripe to start companies or to invest?
I think a big part of it is that it breeds creativity and resourcefulness and amplifies tenacity and focus. You know, when times are tough, you don't have the luxury of making mistakes, you know, over and over and over again. I mean, your every day is about survival, and it sort of forces you to only focus on the things that matter most. And at Picasso, I know we'll probably get to Picasso at some point, but just to fast forward for a moment, at Picasso, we had a little bit of the opposite scenario where we started the company at a challenging time, but a couple months into our journey, it actually turned out to be one of the best times for our business because there was a tailwind of demand during COVID for people who were interested in owning a vacation home. So right out of the gate, we went from this small startup to kind of global industry leader in 18 months. And I kept telling my team during this period that this is not normal. You know, it's not normal for startups to experience this level of product market fit and escape velocity right out of the gate. So let's not get used to it because there will be more challenging times ahead. And it turns out there was more challenging times ahead, you know, starting in kind of late 2022 through where we sit today. So yeah, it was a very different experience. But again, in all the moments that I've had during challenging markets, when I have the opportunity to look back on those markets or those moments, I've always been fortunate for what came out of it.
Did you have a tech background before you started Dotloop, or was that just something you figured out on the fly?
No, I received my undergraduate degree and I had a dual degree in construction management and architectural engineering, of all things. And when I first went into college, I was planning to be an architect. And then that kind of evolved into thinking I would be in construction management. And then I ended up going on to law school, which is kind of a separate story in and of itself. But I definitely didn't have a tech background. So when I decided to start Dotloop, I knew that I would either need to find someone who had a tech background or, you know, figure out how to code. So I started networking and ended up meeting this individual named Matt, who became my co-founder in Dotloop. He was an engineer, had been an engineer kind of his whole life. And I brought like the product vision and the sales and the strategy side of it. And he built the software.
Dotloop is still around today and it's solving an important problem. Why don't you tell us like what the idea was at the time, not what it's evolved to today, but like what was the basic idea of Dotloop at the beginning?
The basic idea was to make buying a home, specifically the transaction and paperwork process, as easy and digital as buying a book on Amazon. And the reason why the idea popped up in my brain as something that I was passionate about and wanted to solve was really driven by the fact that almost everything else I was doing in my life at the time was online. We were shopping online, you know, we were scheduling online, but real estate transactions were very offline. We were still using fax machines. We were using carbon copy forms where you would write on one form and then rip off the copy on the back. And no digital software had really been adopted at scale. So it seemed inevitable to me, like just given that everything else was moving online, it seemed inevitable that real estate transactions would eventually move online. So I thought, you know, why not me? You know, why don't we go try to solve this problem? And then over time, you know, as I got into it, I learned more and more about the space, and I started to understand, you know, why it hadn't happened to date, because the idea of bringing paperwork online was actually not that novel. There were lots of companies who had thought of the idea and tried it prior to Dotloop, but there were a bunch of reasons why nobody had really succeeded at scale. And one of the reasons is that it's very difficult to get a big industry of independent contractors to change their habits. You know, real estate agents, by definition, are pretty independent people. You know, like you're attracted to the real estate industry because you're independently minded, usually entrepreneurial. You're kind of like, you know, you like doing your own thing in your way. And the real estate agents who are really good and are doing well, you know, in their business, they have practices and procedures and systems that work for them. So getting somebody to change their habits is no small feat. And in order for a digital transaction platform to work at scale in an industry like real estate, it's not just about getting, you know, one real estate agent to use the tool. It's about getting an entire industry to change. Because if one person is using the digital tool and the other person is using the paper tool, you know, the least common denominator is where you net out. So it was no small feat to get an entire industry to change their habits. And the business, the product, the go-to-market strategy evolved quite radically over the years in order for us to ultimately succeed.
How did you get traction?
Well, we failed a lot. That was step number one. We first tried selling to real estate agents. That really didn't work. Then we tried selling to real estate offices, like smaller real estate offices. That we were experiencing a little bit of success. Like we would get an office here or there to buy, but then the challenge was other offices in the market weren't using it. So then we went to the trade associations and the MLSs, and they were really receptive. A lot of them were really receptive to the idea, but their business model as a trade association or MLS didn't have the revenue model that would support buying software for all the agents in a market. So while we were gaining interest from that cohort of potential customers, there wasn't a meaningful revenue opportunity. So that wasn't going to be a viable path for us either. So eventually what I decided is I said, you know, in order for this thing to work, we got to figure out how to get to big scale. Like we got to figure out how to get lots of dots on the map all over the country. So I looked up the top 10 largest real estate brands, and I'm forgetting the, you know, stack rank order at the time, but they were big names like Remax, Coldwell Banker. And the fourth one on the list was a brand called Keller Williams Realty. They were the fourth largest in the country at the time. They were growing quickly. And I basically went and knocked on the doors of all these big real estate brands. And everybody in the industry who had been around for a lot longer than me told me this is never going to work. There's no way a big franchisor is going to buy software or provide software to all their agents. That's just not what they do. That's not how their business model works. What they do is they sell franchises, and then they let their franchises and their agents choose how they want to run their business. So most of those efforts were, you know, led to kind of nose at the end of the sales cycle. But we had a break with one firm, and it was that fourth largest firm called Keller Williams Realty. We found them at I think just the right moment in time in their trajectory. There was a new group of leaders in the company that were very motivated to, you know, make a change to the way that the business was running and growing. They had huge ambitions about growth. They viewed technology as a really core pillar of their growth strategy. And we ultimately became a really important part of their tech platform. And it ended up being a huge win-win for both parties. For us, they helped us to put dots on the map all over the country. For them, we helped them to become one of the leaders in tech and become the largest. Today, they're the largest real estate brand in the world. And so it was right place, right time, and a lot of no's before we got to a yes with the right customer.
So when you get entrenched with Keller Williams, does that kind of help you spread a little bit and compound that effort? Because once another agent from Century 21 sees Dotloop coming from a Keller Williams agent, are they like, hey, I want this thing too?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, like most things in life, there's sort of two sides to the sword, meaning if there's an opportunity or something that you're working on that brings a lot of sort of good things, oftentimes there are consequences on the other side. So what was a real advantage of the Keller Williams partnership is that they, through that partnership, we were able to have customers in pretty much every market across the country. And because of the nature of real estate transactions, where you have 80% of the time, you have two different agents from two different brands working on a deal, which meant that every time Keller Williams was creating a transaction on Dotloop, they were 80% of the time, they were inviting another agent from another brand into the deal. And we called that being invited to the loop. So it was like an incredible network effect growth strategy that really wouldn't have been possible without a brand like that. But the downside of getting in so deeply with one brand like that, particularly early in the life of the company, is that everybody else perceived us as like a Keller Williams company. Even though our deal was not exclusive with Keller Williams, everybody else sort of perceived it as if it was. And real estate brands are pretty competitive with one another because they're always out there competing to recruit each other's agents. They're out there competing to win listings, competing to win buyers. So nobody wants to work with a platform that is like deeply integrated with one of their largest competitors. So even though Keller Williams was a huge advantage for us in the early days, it took us 4 or 5 years. I mean, basically until we sold to Zillow, we were constantly fighting this narrative that Dotloop is a Keller Williams shop. And eventually we overcame it and became an industry leader across lots of brands, but it took a while.
What did you learn from that whole experience of just grinding and grinding, grinding through, and then finally figuring it out? Ultimately, you sold Zillow, we'll get there. But what did you learn like through that whole time? A lot of failure, obviously.
Well, the number one lesson that I've learned in business and entrepreneurship is that it's all about the people that you surround yourself with. So it starts with, for me, it started with some of my early mentors, to early investors, to my co-founder, to my employees, to advisors, to our business partners. So the people who I worked with at Keller Williams to get that deal done were integral. Had it not been for those people in those jobs with those ambitions at that moment in time, the deal would have never happened. And then once the deal happened, the work was just getting started. Like just getting the deal done didn't mean that we were going to be successful. We had to successfully deploy it across 70 or 80,000 agents at the time and do that successfully. So there were a ton of partnerships along the way that made that possible. So that's definitely, you know, lesson number one for sure. Lesson number two goes back to what I mentioned earlier about following your passion and like solving a problem that you're passionate about. I was just so passionate about this problem that like nothing else mattered. You know, I was even naive to the fact that we were starting a real estate business in 2008. I mean, that's how maniacally focused I was on this problem. And the reason, there's a couple reasons why that matters a lot when you're building a business. One is that it's very hard to build a business. And if you're just doing it, you know, to make a nice paycheck or to feel, you know, good about yourself, like those things typically don't happen, you know, for a lot of entrepreneurs ever. But if they are going to happen, it happens much later in your career, because early on, it's about like making no money, you know, just getting kind of kicked in the face figuratively every single day, because it's just so hard. And if you're not passionate about the work that you're doing, there's really not much else that is going to enable you to feel sort of encouraged and confident to wake up every day and go after it. But I think the other reason why passion is so important is because it's contagious. So a big part of why this giant company was willing to bet on this tiny little startup with very little proof of concept was because they could feel how passionate we were. You know, they knew that we were going to die trying. You know, we weren't going to like just give up because it got hard. Like, we were going to see this thing all the way through and put everything on the line to make it work for Keller Williams and for us. And I think I think that matters a lot. And I would say the third lesson is probably just around just the old, like, you know, working hard and working smart. Like, I worked super long days, pretty much 7 days a week for most of the Dotloop journey, all the way up until we got acquired. You know, no vacations, no long weekends. I mean, it was just grind, grind, grind. And I was, you know, 23 or 24 when we started the company. So I didn't have a family and kids and, you know, all this other stuff that happens later in life. So I was able to put everything on the line and invest all of my time into this company. But that's kind of what it takes, especially when you're doing it for the first time. It takes a lot of effort. So you got to outwork everybody, but you also have to work smart. There's a lot of people who work really hard for their entire life and you never get ahead. So it's not just the hard work. It's also the smart work. It's like working on the right things, making the right decisions, putting together the right strategy that's not just relevant to your business and the customers that you're going after, but that's relevant to the time that you're operating in. Like, the way that Picasso was operating today, for example, is very different than the way that Picasso was operating in 2021 when we had COVID tailwind and low interest rates. So that's what I would summarize as the top three lessons: people, passion, and hard and smart work.
I love it. Did you graduate law school?
No, I actually left in my final year. It was one of my, you know, still is one of my regrets, although in hindsight, I wouldn't have changed the decision that I made. But the only reason I went to law school was really about academic boot camp. It was about positioning myself with the best, what I thought would be kind of the best skills to be successful in business. I had no intentions of ever practicing law. And I loved law school. I think a lot of people who become lawyers don't necessarily love law school because it's quite intense and stressful and competitive and everybody's trying to compete to be in the top 1%. But for me, it wasn't like that. For me, it was like I was making an investment in my life and in my career. And I loved it. I mean, it taught me how to think. It taught me how to process information. Connected me with an incredible group of people, but I definitely wanted to finish. And when I raised my first angel round of capital in my first year, the first thing that the investor said is, as a condition of the deal, is that you have to drop out of law school. And I said, you know, I'm not going to drop out of law school. You know, a lot of people have hobbies. Other entrepreneurs have hobbies too. Some people choose to mountain bike. Other people choose to read. I choose law school. It's my hobby. So I'm not going to drop out. But what I will promise you is that if the business ever reaches a point where it's so demanding and law school is getting in the way of the business being successful or in the way of me being a, you know, fully present CEO, then I will quit law school. That was the deal that we made. So that lasted about 2 years. And by the time we were 2 years in, I'm traveling all over the country, rolling out Keller Williams, you know, on a plane, 200 plus days a year kind of thing. And law school was getting in the way. So that was the moment in time that I left after my second year. And I had actually planned to go back. I went to the University of Cincinnati Law School, and Chris Collinsworth, the former Bengal, now sportscaster, went to UC Law as well. And when he got drafted for the Bengals, they gave him a leave of absence. So at the UC Law School, they would call this the Collinsworth. So I got the Collinsworth treatment. Law school agreed to let me take a leave of absence, but the leave of absence, you know, never terminated. It's just gone into perpetuity. And now I think I'm well beyond my allowable period. I'd probably have to start over again. So maybe someday they give me an honorary JD. We'll see.
Yeah, they should. I went to law school for the exact same reasons you did. Never practiced, went all the way through, did the bar, but it completely changed the way I think. And at the time, for me, similar to you, it seems, it was like a way to have an edge over people. And I was very entrepreneurial and I didn't want people to kind of like look down on me without experience or without a background. And law school kind of gave me that. And one thing I found really interesting about everything that you're doing is the impact of law and legal stuff. Like even at Picasso, the way you're structuring these deals, it's a very like thoughtful legal way. It's not a tech bro way. Like, yeah, we're just buying these houses. Like, no, it's very thoughtful how a sophisticated person would do it. And obviously Dotloop was all about legal. How did like your 2 years, your 2.5 years, whatever it was at law school help you in the Zillow transaction? Are there any stories that you kind of are remembering or can think of as to how that Zillow transaction came about?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is goes back to the people. So I had developed a relationship with a number of the people at Zillow who were in the executive suite at the time. And I think over time, I really developed a lot of respect for those leaders and for the Zillow business. And I think the respect was mutual from their end. And that led to conversations about how we could partner on things and, you know, work together on different product ideas and stuff. And eventually those conversations led to a point where they expressed interest in buying the company. And I never wanted to sell the company. I always viewed selling a company as a failure. Our plan was to build a big business and take it public and kind of do it on our own, if you will. But above my individual kind of preferences is the mission. And I saw an opportunity with Zillow to fulfill on the mission of the company in a bigger and better way than I thought we would be able to do on our own. So I kind of had to set my pride and my ego aside and think about what's in the best interest of the company and its mission and its employees. And I thought the answer to that was this, you know, partnership and merger with Zillow. So that's kind of how it came about. In terms of the legal aspect of it, I mean, doing a big deal like that is a lot. You know, there's a lot of lawyers. I mean, you know, these transactions can cost millions of dollars in legal fees. There's just a team of people on both sides, you know, 10, 15 lawyers on both sides working around the clock like through the night to get the deal done. There's just an incredible amount of diligence, an incredible amount of, you know, paperwork. So yeah, it was definitely helpful to have a law background, but I wasn't doing the legal work. You know, I was just there trying to, you know, keep everybody motivated and focused to get the deal over the goal line.
I want to transition now a little bit about this whole realtor brokerage commission thing, because you probably understand it better than anyone, given you have seen it complete 360 from all different angles. I always had this perception, you know, that 5 million up, maybe agents are probably adding a lot of value on the sell side. If they're bringing clients with Zillow and everything like that, maybe a little bit less so on the buy side. But it seems like, you know, $1 million to $2 million homes with technology and Zillow, the agent situation beyond like touring people around, taking great photos, could be cut down significantly, particularly on the buy side. So I'm curious to get like your whole take on this whole thing, wherever you want to go with it and where you think it's going to land.
Yeah. Well, I'll caveat before I go into the answer, I'll caveat my answer by saying that I'm not an expert on this subject. I don't follow it super closely because it doesn't influence the Picasso business very much. But at a high level, what I would say is, in my experience, there's a small percent of agents doing the vast majority of the transactions. And that small percent of agents who are doing most of the transactions are quite good and deliver a lot of value to buyers and sellers. And I think that while it is true that over time, technology and AI and other tools will change the way that the real estate transaction works, for the foreseeable future, I think that the great agents have a lot of job security. Will their commission models change and evolve, and some of the rules around how properties are toured and agreements that need to be signed, will those things evolve? Sure. You know, a lot of those things are now kind of mandated as changes on the other side of the settlement. But do I think they're at risk of being put out of business? No, not the good ones, at least not anytime soon. And I think part of what, I mean, for as long as I've been in the industry, which has been 20 something years now, and probably a long time before that, people have been asking this question and predicting that agents are going to be outed. So I may be a little jaded on the topic, because it's just like, I just don't see it happening. It's like, this is such a big transaction for people that just, even if agents are doing nothing other than providing peace of mind and expertise that enables people to feel confident about their decision, which the good ones are doing a lot more than that. But even if that's all that they were doing, I still think there's an incredible amount of value in that. And if you're a seller, for example, you're focused on getting a good deal, getting the best price, getting good terms. There's a lot of legwork involved and getting an expertise involved and getting the property ready. So it's like, yeah, are you going to try to save 5% or 5.5%, whatever the average is, to maybe do it for a little bit less? I mean, it's like, on the margin, is it really worth it? Like, probably not. Like, as a seller, you just want to get the deal done and get a good price and, you know, and not have it wreck your life. So agents do all that stuff. So I see a lot of value for agents on the listing side for sellers. And similarly on the buy side, you know, I think there's still going to be ways for buyer agents to get paid, whether it's, you know, directly from the person buying, whether it's through other, you know, creative things that are happening, you know, at the point of sale that enable dollars to be allocated to buyer commissions. I think there will be a way for buyer agents to continue to get paid. And it's sort of the same thing on the buy side. Even if you're only spending $1 million, $1 million is a lot of money for the people who are buying $1 million houses. $1 million is a lot of money. It's all relative, right? And so do you want to try to skimp a couple percent, you know, on this giant transaction that you don't do very often? I mean, most people only do it a couple times in their lives. So it's like, I don't think so. So I think the good agents have a bright future and a lot of job security. But like any other professional or any other industry, they have to innovate. They can't just keep doing what they used to do in the past and expect it's going to work just as effectively in the future. They have to do what, you know, we do as entrepreneurs. Like because they are entrepreneurs. They have to keep innovating. They have to keep looking for ways to serve their clients better. They have to keep leveraging state-of-the-art tools to be consistent with current expectations. And the good ones are good ones for a reason. It's not because they're lazy. It's because they put in the work and they invest in their business and invest in their customers. And I think anybody who deploys that strategy will be just fine.
Where did you get the idea for Picasso?
So I always dreamed of owning a home because we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And when it was about 10 or 12 years ago now, my wife and I had enough saved up. This was before the Zillow transaction, so I wasn't as liquid as I was post the Zillow transaction, but I had enough money to put down on a second home. And we bought a second home in Lake Tahoe, and it was just a life changer. It was so life enriching for us. That vacation home became even more impactful in many ways than our primary home, because our primary home which was a 600 square foot apartment in San Francisco that we were renting at the time, was just about utility. You know, that's like where I did laundry and dishes and, you know, went to work. But when I was at my vacation home in Lake Tahoe, I was in a different state of mind. You know, it became our happy place. We became part of the community. We met new friends. I pursued hobbies that I didn't have time for in San Francisco or space for in San Francisco. And it was such a life enriching experience that I wanted to find a way to make that possible for more people. So I had been thinking about a version of the Picasso idea for a long time, you know, almost 10 years before we started it. And when I left Zillow in 2019, I knew I was going to start another company, but I wanted to be intentional about that. And I also wanted to take some time off. So I took a year off before starting Picasso. And during that year off, I spent a lot of time researching and thinking about the problem, because just before I left Zillow, I read a quote that was attributed to Einstein, which said that if you had 60 minutes to save the world, you should spend 55 minutes understanding the problem and only 5 minutes on the solution. And that was like the opposite of how I started my first company. My first company was just all solution. I mean, I knew there was a problem, but I didn't really understand it. I just like started building the solution. And so that really resonated with me, because I learned so much about the problem over time through Dotloop. I wanted to be intentional about understanding the problem with Picasso. So during that year off, I talked to a lot of prospective customers. I studied all the business models that had come before us. And I discovered that this idea, which we call co-ownership, some people call it fractional, but the idea is a group of people pulling their resources together to own real estate. This was a common practice that had been around for decades, long before Picasso. We didn't invent it. But the DIY practice of co-ownership is full of problems and risks that make it not really feasible for most people. Like most people who try to own a house with friends or family members end up frenemies at the end of the deal, because there's so many little decisions that need to be made. So the whole idea behind Picasso was, what if we could take this ownership model that's quite proven, been around for a while, but let's just eliminate all the hassle, solve all the problems that are customary with DIY co-ownership, and make this thing mainstream in the same way that Airbnb did for couch surfing. They didn't invent couch surfing. People had been doing that, you know, before, but Airbnb did it better. They built a marketplace and a set of services around this experience that enabled it to become mainstream. And that's the vision that we had for Picasso, is how can we make this ownership structure mainstream and empower a lot more people to have a happy place. The other thing that really influenced my desire to start Picasso, though, was around the problems on the supply side of the second home or vacation home category. Most second homes are sitting empty for 10 to 11 months per year. And when I first bought my home, everybody told me that, and I didn't believe it. I'm like, how in the world could you buy a home and only use it 5 weeks? Well, turns out to be true, because, you know, we have life, you know, and in our normal life, we have all these priorities and commitments, and it's just not practical to be in another place for most people for more than 5 or 6 weeks a year. So empty second homes sitting around these communities is such a problem. It starves the local economy, because there's not owners in the home using the businesses and the services year round. It actually creates more housing affordability challenges, because second homeowners are taking supply off the market and allowing the supply to sit empty. So a really important pillar of our strategy was around making better use of what would otherwise been empty second homes. So co-ownership is like what carpooling is to traffic and pollution. Co-ownership is that for second homes. We're pulling people together, aggregating demand, and concentrating that demand into fewer homes. So it creates more opportunities for the local workforce to buy median price homes, because they're no longer competing with as many vacation home buyers. And our homes that we manage end up being utilized like a primary home, because you have owners in the home year round. It's not just occupied 5 weeks a year. The owners are kind of, you know, sharing access to the home year round. which means there's always owners supporting local businesses. So it was the combination of those two insights. How do we make owning and finding a happy place possible for more people in a hassle-free way? That was like the demand innovation. The supply innovation was, how do we make better use of these empty second homes? And we came together. I reached out to, right after I left Zillow, Spencer Raskoff, who's my co-founder in Picasso. He was the CEO of Zillow for about 13 years. He left Zillow. He was one of the guys that I built a relationship with, that where we shared a bunch of mutual respect. So we started talking about how we might be able to work together. He had some ideas. I had this idea, and we both really connected on this idea, and we decided to come together and you know, do this together. So we ended up starting Picasso in early 2020. We raised our first seed round, which was more like we kind of skipped the seed. We really went straight to the Series A. And then we ended up launching Picasso in October of 2020.
So there's so many questions. I don't know where I want to start. Okay, here's where we'll start. When you and Spencer were kind of thinking through this idea and you were raising the Series A or the seed, were there guardrails that you kind of put on the strategy or the focus area as you were trying to articulate the business to investors, like, oh, we're only going to focus on homes in these markets, or is it much more broad? Like, was there price ranges? Like, how did you think about it initially?
Well, before I get to that question, your question sparked another sort of related question, which is like something that I spent a lot of time thinking about before we started the company, which is I wanted to work on a bit. I was hoping that this next business could be a business that I could work on for the rest of my life. You know, if successful, I could see myself, you know, being at Picasso for 20, 30 years. I sort of thought about what would have to be true about the business in order for that vision to become a reality. And there were three sort of circles that I drew on my whiteboards, and there was like a, you know, kind of a Venn diagram with three circles where they overlapped in the middle. And I think I actually got this. I can't remember where I got this. It might've been from a Jim Collins book or something, but what I was trying to do at the middle of these three circles is I was trying to figure out, what am I like very good at? Like, where am I uniquely advantaged as an individual and as an entrepreneur? That was question number one. Question number two was, I wanted to make sure it was a business that could have like a really big impact, like big TAM, impact a lot of people, deliver a lot of value. And then the third thing that I was thinking about was a business that would have really strong unit economics that could enable us to get to a large scale and large market cap. Because one of the many lessons I learned at Dotloop was that just getting to a lot of market share doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate into a lot of market cap unless there's a strong revenue model and an addressable market behind it. So we at Dotloop, I mean, we were more than half of transactions in the US, which is a ton. I mean, when you think about that kind of market share in a category as big as US residential real estate, that doesn't happen very often. It was an incredible amount of market share. But yet it was a pretty small outcome. It was a $120 million outcome. And I mean, still a great outcome for me and the company, but like relative to the market share, it was a small outcome. You know, most companies that have that kind of market share in such a big category are in the billions of dollars of market cap. And the reason why it was a smaller outcome is because of our revenue model. If we would have been getting paid $100 per transaction, for example, you know, Dotloop could have been worth billions, but we weren't. We had this like subscription-based model. We were selling into the productivity budgets of real estate offices, and there just weren't a lot of dollars available for productivity budgets within real estate offices. So it was the intersection of those three things that enabled me to really lock in on Picasso as the right idea, because real estate and vacation homes in particular was an area that I had spent a lot of time on, been associated with other businesses in the space, and was incredibly passionate about it. It was a huge, huge market opportunity. I mean, there's like almost 10 million second homes in the US alone, and probably 100 million around the world. And most of them are sitting empty. So giant, giant impact potential. And also an incredible revenue model, because we deliver so much, co-ownership delivers so much value, because it's enabling people to spend like 85% less than what it would cost them to buy and operate the same home on their own. So we're able to charge, you know, 12 to 15% as a service fee on top of the real estate, which is, you know, a pretty significant amount of money per deal. When you're selling, you know, $500,000 to $800,000 shares, it's a lot of gross profit per deal. So the combination of those three things really enabled me to kind of hone in on Picasso as the right opportunity. In terms of your other question around kind of how we pitched the original business to people, we really envisioned that Picasso would be more of a asset light marketplace, in the same way that Airbnb is an asset light marketplace. They connect aspiring travelers with, you know, hosts basically that own the homes. So our vision was to connect aspiring home owners with empty second homes, not to be in the middle of, you know, buying the real estate and owning the assets. But what happened was in 2020, like late 2020 and all of 2021, the vacation home market picked up so fast and interest rates were so low that homes were selling in days, you know, and weeks as an average. So the idea of aggregating enough demand to be able to transact before the home was sold was unrealistic. The only way to get good inventory was to actually buy the home. So while we pitched this original vision for asset light marketplace, the business early days evolved to have this like asset intensity component, where we were basically like using debt capital and equity capital that we had raised to buy the home, and then we would sell it and syndicate demand after the fact. But over the course of the years, we've been migrating back towards the asset light model, where, you know, last year on average, I'd say 50% or so, like when we first started, only one of the eight shares would have been pre-sold before we closed. By the time we finished 2023, we were averaging like four of the eight shares pre-sold. And now we're averaging more than that. So someday, you know, I hope to get to a point where like all the demand is pre-aggregated before we ever transact on a home. But it's a process, you know, there's an element of just transaction complexity that we take care of, which makes buying a Picasso so easy. But when we bring a Picasso into the Picasso ecosystem, we still have to go through the traditional process of buying and closing and title and escrow and all that stuff. So sometimes it requires us to be involved in buying a portion of the asset. But I would say that's the biggest thing that changed about the business model, is like asset light vision to kind of asset heavy launch, to over the course of the last few years, we're migrating back towards the asset light vision.
I love the first part of your answer, because it's really interesting. A big real estate investor that I know, we were once talking about someone else, and he's like, oh, this guy, he develops the best projects, they're the most amazing, they're the best vibe, but he structures the worst deals. Like, he doesn't know how to structure a deal. And I think a lot of people get carried away with the fun or the ego. And I'm wondering if you could break down like the different business revenue opportunities in Picasso right now, and how you set it up to actually generate that market cap, as opposed to just creating all this excitement, but with no real business behind it.
Yeah, well, the way that we think about our business is like a tech-enabled marketplace, but within the marketplace, there's a bunch of services, many of which we're providing, that make this ownership experience possible. And anytime we're providing the service, that is a revenue opportunity for us. So the primary revenue streams that we have are, first and foremost, is our service fee. So a service fee is effectively a markup on the real estate. And that's what we get paid for putting the whole thing together. You know, we find the properties, we aggregate the buyers, we have to invest in sales and marketing to bring all these people together and get a deal done. We're setting up operating agreements and all this stuff to like make the co-ownership thing possible.
The cost of building the dream.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got real costs. It's not all, you know, margin. Like we call it gross profit, but there's real cost in generating that gross profit. And that is 12 to 15% of the purchase price of a share. So if you just think about that revenue opportunity alone, I mean, there's, you know, 9 million, or let's just look at the global opportunity. Let's just, for simple math, let's call it 100 million second homes. And if we had 1% of that market at someday at the high end, so call it, you know, $1 million, $2 million average, even though our average today is much higher than that. We started very luxury and serve a pretty high net worth audience today. But over the long term, I mean, what's that math? 1 million times $2 million. What's that? 2 billion or 20 or no, 20?
A million times billion? 2 billion? 20 billion?
Yeah, it's a lot. Or 2 trillion? I haven't done this. 200 billion.
200 billion. Let's go with it.
Yeah, it's a big, I think it's 200 billion.
My brain's fried. I can't do million dollar math right now.
Yeah, but I don't have a calculator in front of me, but it's a big number. It's a giant, giant number. Okay.
Giant number.
It's either big TAM. I think it's 200 billion. It's a big number. So do the math on collecting, you know, 12 to 15% of that. That's just 1% of the market with our service fee alone. So that's just that business model is giant, but it doesn't stop there, because once the home is a Picasso, it sort of stays a Picasso indefinitely. And there's all these other services that we're providing, from financing. 70% of people who buy a Picasso get financing, and all of that flows through us because there are no other co-ownership mortgages. We created it. So the financing side of the business is interesting. Property management. We're managing all these properties as well. And we get a, you know, market price. We actually charge a little less than market rates. We benchmark against what third party management would cost. And we try to be 10 to 15% less than that, but it's still a nice business at scale. Resales. When somebody buys a Picasso, just like buying a whole home, some people decide to resell and move into a different property, and we get paid real estate commissions on those. Furniture, over time, we see an opportunity to become a furniture platform because we have state-of-the-art, you know, design, and we're delivering enough furniture in these homes that at the right moment, you could easily see where we could start to have our own furniture that enables us to make nice margins on that. So those are just a few examples of the types of services that happen in the marketplace that kind of live on into perpetuity. So yeah, it's a really, really big market opportunity. And it's like the thing about monetization that I always try to think about anytime we're like pricing a new product is I try to think about it in the context of the value that we're providing to the customer. Like, the value that you're providing to the customer needs to be, you know, ideally a lot higher than what they're paying, you know? So like in our case, take the service fee, for example. In the resort industry that had come before us, like if you were to buy from a big hotel brand that has a fractional product, the typical markup with those resort properties is 50 to 100%. So a piece of real estate that would have otherwise costed $4 million in XYZ ski community, they mark it up to $8 million and then they sell it in quarters or eighths. Our markup's only 12 to 15%, like very, very low relative to the industry adjacent comps. But it's like a nice margin or it's a nice chunk of gross profit if you do the math per unit at 500,000 or so is our average share price today. That's, you know, $60,000 to $70,000 or so of gross profit on a single transaction. So it's a great business model. The challenge with the business model, which is also our blessing, our biggest curse is also our biggest blessing, is that it's complicated. It is very hard, very, very hard to do this business at scale, like managing lots of properties where you don't have density in a given market. Owners are moving in and out of the property every week or every couple of weeks. There's a lot of, you know, capital that's required to front load the onboarding of the inventory. It's a hard business to do, But that's kind of our advantage. You know, it's really hard for someone to recreate it in the same way that it's hard for someone to recreate Amazon. Like intuitively, what Amazon does, they put widgets in their website for people to buy. That's not very, you know, novel by today's standards. But for somebody to do it like Amazon does, with the scope of options and the consistency and speed of delivery and the cost, you know, competitive nature, like just how competitive their pricing is, that would be really hard for somebody to recreate. The Picasso business is kind of like that. The whole package is what makes this thing special. And it's a hard business.
There was a bunch of like tech-enabled real estate companies that kind of got SPAC'd up or that had a lot of challenges. Obviously, okay, the most famous is WeWork. Sonder is another one. Sonder just announced a deal today with Marriott, which is actually, you know, from my perspective, I think pretty interesting. If you're a Sonder investor, it's super interesting. What did you see from some of those companies that maybe didn't work or had a lot of built-in challenges that you specifically tried to position Picasso in a different way as you were building it at the same time as those things were maybe, you know, before you, or you could see how they were being perceived or the mistakes they were making?
Well, I would say it's really easy to fall into the trap of judging another business from the outside. And, you know, I have enough on my plate with running Picasso that I don't have time to think about, you know, what others are dealing with. So I don't know that I could speak to specifics on kind of what went right or wrong with various businesses that have not gone as planned. But I would say one general theme that persists across a lot of the companies that I think you're alluding to is the asset intensity of them. You know, companies that had to raise a lot of cash, raise a lot of debt, buy a lot of real estate, which comes with a lot of liability. You know, that model is by definition highly levered, which means that the more you lever, kind of the more risk is at play. So when things like interest rates change dramatically or buyer demand trends change dramatically and you find yourself holding a lot of real estate with heavy carry costs and big debt facilities with covenants that are coming due, you know, you can get yourself into a situation pretty quickly that's problematic. So I think that would be the main theme, is just like the asset intensity and the balance sheet complexity and risk that comes with being a business like that. So this goes back to the conversation we were having just a moment ago about how our model has evolved. Like in a perfect world, we would never own a single dollar of real estate. Like we do not aspire to own real estate or to buy real estate. We simply do it as a means to an end to facilitate, with the end being delivering happy places to our customers, right? We only do it as necessary to put, you know, match aspiring homeowners with the home of their dreams. We're not doing it because we're like speculating on real estate or trying to hold equity in real estate. And there's a bunch of reasons why we aspire to be asset light, but probably the biggest reason is that it's just, I think it's a better and easier, if you can do it, it's a better way to scale a business. So that would kind of be the main theme that I would notice. And the other thing, just to be fair to all the companies, you know, in this space, is we were operating in a very different environment over the course of the last few years. Like all the way up, you know, I don't know when I can't remember back to when I would attribute the real frothiness to start. It was like a progression, right, that happened all the way up through the middle of 2022. But like just taking the period that we were in, which was 2021 and the first half of 2022, like interest rates were next to nothing. Capital was abundant at, you know, great terms. I mean, people were just pouring money into exciting businesses with big TAMs. So you'd kind of be, in my opinion, you would have been crazy as an entrepreneur if you had access to that kind of capital at good terms to not take it. right? Because that was the game that was being played at the time. You couldn't possibly compete with another company that had access to more cash at better terms. Like, that was what was necessary in that time to succeed and thrive in these businesses. And what I don't think any of us were able to predict, though, is how quickly that environment changed. You know, interest rates effectively tripled in a pretty short period of time. And
everyone in real estate got smoked.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so it's easy to look at this stuff in hindsight and say we shouldn't have done that or can't believe they did that. But like, I think a lot of those companies like that you're alluding to played their cards right at the time. It just changed quicker than any of us could have imagined. And, you know, we were fortunate that, you know, and I'll call it a little lucky, I guess, that we raised a nice big round, our Series C, just before everything turned. And so when it turned, we had a lot of cash in the bank and we were able to make some hard decisions and adjust our expense base and position the company to weather the storm without being dependent upon a next round of capital. We were also able to, we have an incredible team at Picasso that has a lot of experience doing big scale real estate stuff, which meant that we were able to put good partnerships in place with our lenders that didn't have these, you know, really fatal, you know, covenants that were coming due at unfortunate times. So I don't know if that was us being smart or us being lucky or a combination of both. But it put us in a position to be able to weather the storm without having to raise another round of capital during this period.
Because there is an asset management component to your business, are you trying to like curate locationally markets so you can kind of cluster team members near a certain area or by geographic region so it makes it easier for you guys? And obviously vacation markets lend themselves to that anyways, but is that part of the focus?
We're mostly demand driven in the way that we think about market expansion, meaning when we have buyers telling us to go in XYZ market, if our signals are telling us there's enough demand to, you know, sell some Picassos in that market, that's kind of what that's the number one input that influences which markets we go into. And we've designed the business model in such a way that it, while it is very complex, as we talked about before, we've been able to be tech first in the way that we scale and in the way that we provide services so that we can support markets without any employees initially in the market. So we can actually add a home in a market and we partner with local vendors, like we'll partner with a local property manager. We have built systems that enable us to deliver a consistent standard, whether it's us doing the property management or a partner. And that enables us to get started in markets without having to hire people. And then once we reach a certain scale in a market with a certain number of homes, then it makes sense for us to start to in-house some of those services and actually hire people in the market. But we're fully remote as a company for the most part. I mean, we do have a couple of small offices, but for the most part, we're remote. We don't have like a, you know, big corporate headquarters where everybody operates and everything is kind of done on Zoom. So that enables us to be pretty flexible with respect to how we follow our customers and the markets where they want us to be. But I will say that's another one of the examples of why this business is complicated and hard. Like if just take a hotel as an example. With a hotel, you've got a lot of rooms in a single place and a lot of consistency. Like every room has the same air conditioner, the same carpet, you know, so it's a lot easier to run a portfolio of units that are in the same building. There's just economies of scale that you don't get when you're running a portfolio of very luxury homes that are distributed across a big, you know, geography. But that's also what makes our business really interesting and unique. So we've had to design it to support that complexity right out of the gate, because we knew the business wouldn't be as interesting if all of our homes were in one market. I mean, part of what makes the business really interesting is we have homes in 40 markets in the US, plus Paris and London, Cabo. And once you become a Picasso owner, you have the ability to swap with other Picasso owners. So if you own a Picasso in Napa, but you want to go to Paris to see the Olympics, you know, you can do that. And so the scale of the business is, I think, a pretty important part of the value proposition for our customers.
How do you think about like master planned resort communities? Because it's obvious that there's huge demand to get in there. Prices have gotten out of control in a lot of places. I'm sure a lot of people would love to own it fractionally. Is there pushback? Like, do you find obstacles there? Is it pretty easy for you guys to get into, whether they're tied to a hotel or just a beautiful resort community? Or is it easier to just do one-off homes?
We haven't done a lot of resort community sort of projects yet. Part of the reason why is because in the first couple years of the business, the market was so good that the resort developers really didn't need or want to do anything that was outside of the box. You know, they had more buyers than homes, and we were offering something that was kind of new and different that they just didn't need at the time. So we've always been interested in working with resort developers. They just, you know, there hasn't been as much need until now. But now we are starting to see a lot more resort developers, you know, reach out to us. We've got a really cool program. We call it Powered by Picasso, where a resort developer can essentially leverage the infrastructure, the co-ownership infrastructure and tools that we've built to make co-ownership available as part of their resort development. And the advantage to them is it enables them to sell more units, right? There's just a lot more people who would be willing to buy a fourth of a $4 million home than people who would be willing to buy 100% of it, given the usage that we talked about earlier. So I think as time goes on, I could certainly see more resort and hotel-like properties becoming available, you know, through Picasso in some capacity. But it hasn't been a big part of what we've done to date for the reasons that I mentioned a moment ago.
And actually, in that segment, if you're kind of only marking it up 12 to 15%, these resort developers, if they're doing a fractional program, it's like you said, it's 100%, 200%. There's a project in Aspen that I know of where if you look at these units that are fractionals on a per square foot basis, you know, you're paying the equivalent of like $10,000 a foot, which is way more than you'd ever pay with Picasso. So whether they take your model, use your platform, whatever, I think it's a huge opportunity for them and for you, because people only use these things 5 weeks out of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, there's what we found is there's some people really like the resort lifestyle. They like the amenities, having everything in one place. If there's a hotel brand, they like having an adjacent hotel for guests to stay. But there's other people that also really prefer kind of the standalone single family home, where you're sitting on a few acres, have a lot of privacy. There's no other house that's just like theirs. It's unique. And one of the other cool things about this model is that you're buying real estate. So like prior to Picasso, there was never a way to buy an eighth of a home or a quarter of a home and then sell that quarter. Like if you were to do this on your own prior to Picasso, like with three of your buddies and then one person wanted out, there was no way for that one person to get out. The only way to get out was to sell the whole home. So we've created a secondary market for these partial interests in homes that never existed before. And the secondary market is actually performing better than whole homes in the markets where we operate. We just conducted a third party study, or we hired a third party to conduct a study to just see how our resale market was performing relative to the market at large. And we found that in the markets where we operate, appreciation during the period that we studied was about 5% on, you know, second homes in these communities. And appreciation on Picasso units was about 10%. So you get the benefit of, you know, hotel-like consistency, although it's not quite hotel-like. Like we're not providing room service, we're not providing concierge services, but it's kind of like as close as you can get to a hotel-like experience in a single family home. That's what you get with Picasso. And the consistency and the elevated nature of that experience is elevated above what you can get anywhere else. You know, you can't get it by renting somebody else's Airbnb, because the nature of that offering is just different. You know, it's not as consistent. Every host creates their own experience. Whereas when you buy a Picasso, you get a consistent, elevated luxury experience every single time, but you still have the benefit of owning real estate. So as that real estate appreciates in value over time, you're the owner of it, not Picasso. And so it's kind of like the best of all worlds, right? Real estate ownership plus travel in this like hotel-like, very consistent kind of experience that is hassle-free.
When I was preparing for our conversation, I think I popped on your website and I saw Brendan from Fifth Wall, who I met once before. He, I think, invested in your platform and also owns something. That's what he said in the website. And he bought something in London. And I was like, wow, that's a whole opportunity that I didn't even think about, because I think a lot of people would like to own a home internationally, but for tax, legal, a million different reasons, cost, they might not want to do it solo. How do you think about the international market, and how has that been for you?
The international market has been great. So yeah, you're right. Brendan with Fifth Wall is one of our big investors. They co-led our Series C with SoftBank. And I think he's a quarter share owner actually in London. And you're right. I mean, the international value proposition with Picasso is incredible. I mean, our domestic value proposition is strong also. You save a lot of money and save a lot of hassle. But the value proposition internationally is even greater, because it's such a pain in the neck to try to buy a property, you know, overseas. Like if you lived in the, if you're a US, you know, citizen and you want to buy a property in Paris, for example, just imagine the scale of that undertaking. I mean, you're probably going to spend, depending on the size of the project, thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars on legal services, tax services. You got to find local people that you trust, that know the market. And it's probably a 6-month process to do that on your own, plus a lot of money. With Picasso, you can be an owner in Paris tomorrow. You know, we have done all the work. We have the people, the experts in market, and we really make it seamless. So we're seeing a lot of interest internationally. And another thing that's been really interesting is like kind of the profile of customer that is buying a Picasso. While the thing that attracted me most to co-ownership initially, and is still very sort of central to our long-term vision, is making the home ownership dream possible for more people. Like someday when we fast forward, you know, 20 years, I expect that you will be able to buy Picassos at a very vast range of price points, you know, maybe as low as $50,000 or $100,000 a share, all the way up to, you know, we have $2 or $3 million shares today. But we started the brand in this very luxury kind of high end segment of the market. And what we found is that those are the buyers that are kind of most active in this moment in time. I think it's probably largely driven by kind of the turbulence and the uncertainty in the macro environment. Like if you don't have significant net worth and significant discretionary income, you're less likely to buy a vacation home. But our product today is, you know, quite luxurious, appeals to a very high-end audience, and makes things like international buying possible in ways that just weren't practical in the past.
Do you own any shares? Like obviously the company owns some, but have you decided to do it?
Yeah. I own a quarter share in a Picasso, and yeah, I love it.
I can think there's a million different things that can go wrong with a home. Let's just say you guys take care of it. What are the most common objections that you've gotten, and how have you solved those as you've continued to grow?
The most common objection/question relates to scheduling. People want to know, are they going to get the time that they want in the home? And the answer to that is, that you'll get most of the time that you want. You're not going to get all of the time that you want because you don't own 100% of the home. You're going to get, call it 80 or 85% of the time that you want. But most of our customers are really happy to make that trade-off because they're saving 85% of the cost and 100% of the hassle. And the way that we manage the time is through an app that we've created. And within the app, there is a calendar feature that we call Smart Stay. Smart Stay is like a shared calendar with a series of rules and algorithms that distribute the calendar fairly and equitably amongst the ownership group. So if you own an eighth of the home, you're going to get 1/8 of the peak season, 1/8 of the non-peak season, and 1/8 of the holidays. And if you really want more of the, you know, preferred dates that are top of your list, you just buy a quarter share. And when you buy a quarter share, you get double the, you know, authority, if you will, in the scheduling algorithm. And for most people, a quarter share is, you know, a lot more than they'll actually use in a given year.
Are you seeing challenge in very seasonal markets like, I don't know, Nantucket, where it's only good for 2 or 3 months out of the year versus Paris, which is good every single day of the year?
The model applies everywhere and works everywhere, but I would say the appeal is broader in markets with longer seasons or multiple seasons. So the best markets are like mountain towns that have really strong winters and really strong summers, or places like Cabo or Paris or London that really don't have seasons, you know, I mean, in terms of traveler demand. Like Cabo, you do have a month a year that's hurricane season. But other than that, I mean, Cabo is quite pleasant year round. So the longer the season, the stronger the value proposition, because the more good, if you will, time you're going to get throughout the year.
The last place I want to go is how you solve the financing problem. I mean, you're already helping because someone's buying an eighth or a quarter, so it's less cash that they have to come up with. But how did you think about financing in this co-ownership structure?
Well, we knew that we would have to solve the problem because prior to Picasso, the only way to get a loan on a co-owned property was to get a traditional mortgage and have everybody sign on the traditional mortgage with joint and several liability. And the reason why that's a problem is this is true if people know each other, but it's particularly true when people don't know each other. If one person defaults with joint and several liability, everybody's on the hook equally. So that's kind of a, you know, scary proposition, right? So we knew that we would need to solve that problem. So we effectively, in partnership with a number of large lending institutions, kind of created a co-ownership loan product whereby if someone were to default, and we've not yet had a default, someday I'm sure we will on one of our loans, but if or when somebody defaults, Picasso is the one that steps in, forecloses on the share, and deals with that so that the other owners don't have to worry about it. So it was one of these like kind of core legs to the stool, if you will, that we felt like needed to be in place in order for the co-ownership model to be attractive to a broad audience. So it was one of the first things that we focused on. And we've been fortunate to have some great partners on the capital side that helped us to innovate on that product.
When's St. Bart's coming? Do you have any St.
Bart's properties? Well, I don't have specific plans, but if you're ready to be what we call a lead buyer and bring some friends, we can make it happen sooner rather than later.
I love it. I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and that's, what's your favorite hotel?
Probably Aman Giri. Yeah, you know, that little bit of a cliche answer, but it's just such a cool, just so different, you know what I mean? To put a masterpiece like that in the middle of nowhere and to experience it is a really special thing. So I would say that's top of the list.
Yeah, we had Homie, who owns it, on the show. I actually spoke to his son yesterday. It's an amazing property. I think they have real estate there. So maybe you need to.
Yeah, I saw that.
You guys together. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I mean, that would be an obvious choice for someone to split a place with some people.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, who's going to spend all year there, right? No one, right? It's like the perfect place to co-own. So yeah, please make the connection.
Let's do it. Thanks for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jake.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.